Hey, what's up, sinners and choosers? Welcome to Choosing Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Got a great episode for you this week with Devin Field. Devin is a writer for Jimmy Kimmel. He also wrote for the Oscars because he's a writer for Jimmy Kimmel. And he's coming out with a Comedy Central half hour later this year. And I don't have a release date for that yet, but I will definitely keep you guys posted. It's awesome having him over, hearing the perspective of somebody who is raised not super religious. He does tell me a lot how he's gotten into transcendental meditation. So talk about transcendental meditation. We talk about plant medicine, a bunch of other cool stuff. And I had a lot of fun doing this one. Outside of this, I left my day job, which is scary, exciting, and scary. And I'm really excited. I mean, I'm taking time off to work on a book and a bunch of other comedy projects, and including more of these. And I don't know what the next chapter for me is going to look like. I kind of know what the current chapter is going to look like, but I don't know what the next chapter, much less the chapters beyond that, are going to look like. And so it's exciting. It's kind of anxious. But overall, definitely excited to be on this part of the journey. And part of that journey includes live Choose Your Own Religion shows, which are not like the podcast, but they are a bunch of comics doing religious material, some improv teams doing made-up Bible stories or Bhagavad Gita stories or whatever it is. This week, if you're hearing this the week it comes out, on May 6th, I've got Lissa Mandel, Rachel Mack, and Scott Lors all doing stuff, and they're sure to delight. And I think it's going to be a great show. You should come. It's Sunday, May 6th. We're always on the first Sundays of the month at 6:30 in the clubhouse in Los Feliz. More info, you can go to Choose Your Religion Facebook page. There will be info of it there. Oh, and one last thing. So you'll hear that the sound quality in this episode was a little off. Devin sounds great. But at some point when I had gone on location with one of my microphones, I had done something to completely remove like the bass element of my voice, or I completely messed up the EQ on my channel. And so you'll hear Devin sounds like he's here in the room, and then I sound like I'm kind of on a video conference. But I was right there in the room with him. And I think you kind of forget about it after a while, but you'll notice that early on. It sounds like I'm calling it a web show. But don't you worry. I promise you, we were really face-to-face. In case that's really a deal-breaker for you, you need all your podcasts face-to-face. Anyway, besides that, I love you. Here's Devin Field.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
I went ahead and kicked it off.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I probably won't include any
Mark
of that.
Mark Maron style.
I mean, that's the way to do it.
It's the only way.
Although I am, like, are you aware? We don't have to include this part either.
Sure.
But are you, like, aware of, like, when you're working for Kimmel, when you're right, are you aware of, like, the ratings? Are you guys, is that something that they, like, oh, man, it's down this week or it's down tonight or whatever?
That feels, like, very individual. Like, some people at the office really follow it and some don't. There's definitely, like, a ton of people whose job it is to follow that. Like,
right,
obviously,
right,
a lot of the producers are, like, pretty keyed into that.
Yeah.
Us at the writer level doesn't come up a ton. We're sort of aware of like broad strokes trends, but I don't even know what place we're in right now. Because that's really all you're ever doing is kind of sizing up like where are we in relation to Fallon and Colbert.
Right.
And and it feels like in the last year, those have kind of moved around a lot.
Yeah,
those places. Well, so
things are changing so much. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, even from a pure consumer standpoint, who's not on the inside of that, like, I feel like it's more, you get bite size, like, because the internet's just changing how we consume every kind of media and content.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, I'll get like a
a bit here or a skit here. I'll hear like this yeah. one joke or whatever.
Overall viewership for late night TV on the major three networks is so much lower than it was even like a decade ago for exactly that reason. And that's why you end up with like spinoff shows like Carpool Karaoke or whatever, because that's kind of the way people watch, is they see on YouTube, oh, a new Carpool Karaoke video with James, you know, and that's the 6 minutes of James Corden you see in a month, probably.
Right.
You know, and like, same with Kimmel, of like, you know, a couple big monologues or like the signature like bits of like mean tweets or something. It's like people kind of catch those. And then other than that, yeah, like the number of people who kind of sit down and watch a full episode, like as it rolls out, I think way, way lower than forever ago.
Word.
Yeah.
So I wanted, it's been like, I feel like we used to see each other a lot at mics like several years ago.
Yeah.
And then I saw you a couple years ago, like once or twice.
Yeah.
And then it's been another couple years since I've seen you.
Yes.
Neither any of those times did we talk remotely about religion or spirituality.
Not even close.
Not even close.
No.
I have no idea what's going on with you in your life other than like you seem to be killing it, generally speaking.
Just murdering. Just crushing from afar. That's my religion.
But really, what I need to ask you, Devin, is
yes.
how's your spiritual life doing?
My spiritual life is...
do you believe in a spiritual life?
I do. I believe in that broad term.
Okay.
In terms of my background, I was raised with no religion of any kind.
Okay.
Not even presented with an option of a religion, really.
Really?
Yeah. And so I thought maybe that would be interesting in the context of this. How many times have you had people on who were raised like absolutely nothing?
A handful. I'm struggling to remember specifically who other than, you know, Miles K.
Sure.
I remember he was raised, but he was almost even raised like specifically atheist, which is maybe different than
it is
being
different because that was not my
whatever.
Experience.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a different thing that I've encountered a fair amount of. And I'd say I'm probably like borderline that, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that my parents raised me to be an atheist. But both my parents are atheists.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, it was just not presented to us like at all. I think my dad was a little less interested in kind of any religious side than my mom was. I'm pretty sure my dad's side of the family also grew up kind of with none of that.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas my mom kind of dabbled in it. Like my mom moved around a lot, and she was in high school in Virginia, and she was her high school's chaplain. So she would like read the prayers at the football games.
Sure.
And
okay.
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she went through kind of like a teenage like Christian phase, but then her side of the family lived on my grandpa Robert, my grandparents got divorced, and my grandpa Robert ended up kind of getting into the 60s and went and lived on a commune in Mendocino.
Tight.
And so some of the kids came and they took like nature names and stuff. And so then that half of the family kind of split in terms of like religious or not. And so my mom's interest in that eventually faded away. And then she became, you know, an anthropologist and a professor. So like a very kind of like atheist track, would say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's something that seems like a, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so it's like my parents were both just kind of set up that way. I feel like they both came from families that kind of like turned away from religion. I'm not really sure what my dad's side of the family story was, but I think he was just kind of raised without it. And then my mom's side, my grandpa Robert, who got into the 60s, he grew up in a religious sect in Washington State called The Meeting.
Okay.
Which is like, I'm not going to get all this right, but it's sort of like Quaker-esque.
Okay, yeah, yeah, because Quakers have meetings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of Quaker-esque, but it was kind of hardcore.
Okay.
In that like women were not allowed to speak in the meeting unless spoken to, like at kind of official sort of church gatherings. Like, women are not allowed to speak unless they're directly addressed.
All right.
And, you know, just kind of like hardcore small town, like rural Washington State kind of conservative religious Christian sect.
Okay. Okay.
And I think my grandpa ended up rebelling against that pretty hard.
I see.
I think that was a pretty big head trip to lay on like an 18-year-old kid.
Yeah, I imagine so. And that's like another legacy of like people who have moved west, is like, because, you know, if the Pilgrims were like the original people who were like seeking what religious, trying to escape religious persecution in England, and then there's a whole other, I mean, Mormons moving completely west to escape that on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And then I imagine there's lots of sects, like the meeting.
I think so.
The 50% quiet meeting.
Yes, the very silent meeting. Yeah, and it was, I think that's true of, like, you see that a lot with the settling of the West, is that those were, like, new territories that people were able to do their weird religious shit.
Yeah, and something I was wondering, I was, like, thinking about, too, as you're talking, like... Yeah. Now, it sounds like your grandpa had more of like a direct, like, rebellious kind of, maybe.
I think so.
Yeah. But like, you know, I'm curious about like the people, I'm not saying your family was like this, but like people in general who over in the history and like centuries ago who were like maybe quietly atheist, or like there had to have been some atheist people who just, they couldn't say it. You couldn't openly be atheist back then. Or like they were like only barely religious. They were like,
I think,
culturally religious,
that,
like in the way that some people barely know the rules of football just so they can watch the Super Bowl.
Yes, yeah. Kind of the way I watch March Madness, is where like I followed none of it for the entire year, then catch like 6 games, and I'm like, boy, basketball's a great. You can always tell. my casual sports fan thing is that all my commentary is just how amazing it is. He's like, wow, that's incredible athleticism to just run for 45 minutes. Everyone else has like accepted that as the baseline of like, yeah, that's how basketball works, is the run.
I mean, I used to be so, I mean, I'm from, I went to North Carolina. I went to, so I'm like, it was like, used to be much more obsessed with March Madness. Yeah. And then like, I've gotten, it's harder and harder for me to keep track these days. And now like I used to watch every opening game I could on like the whole weekend. And then now I like, I'm watching it, and I'm like, it's just, there's too many teams. There's just, I can't keep track of any. There's too many potential storylines for me.
It's a
like,
lot.
It's just a blur of really athletic guys.
And they're all younger than you. Yeah. What I don't understand is, I don't understand how anyone follows regular season college basketball, just because there is so much. There's so much when you get to March Madness. Like March Madness is a huge amount of teams and games.
Right.
And there's so many different divisions, I feel like completely different skill levels, and I just wouldn't even know where to find regular season college basketball.
Yeah, well, I mean, even as some, so like when I went to Carolina, like I went to like every home game, like while I was a student. Like,
that's
cool. I was
obsessed
with it. Like,
that's awesome.
But it is sort of, I've like talked about this a long time ago, but it's like, it is like a religion in the sense that for a lot of people, it's like,
huge.
It's like, well, it's like, and it's like baseball. It's like, you're going because of the ritual, you're seeing the pageantry. There's like there's a regular establishment to how every game goes.
Michael Jordan is Jesus.
Exactly.
To UNC.
He was. And, you know, Dean Smith is the father.
Yes, that's
Michael
right.
Jordan's the son.
I don't know
and,
who the ghost is.
Yeah. Who's
the mascot? The who's the mascot?
Ramses.
Ramses.
Which is, you know, it's fucking Ramses.
Yeah, it's a Ramses. That's crazy.
But but even then, like, you know, and I would watch a lot of other regular season basketball too.
Yeah.
During that time, but even then, it's like you couldn't really keep up with like what was happening across the rest of the country, which is why like polls are so stupid. Like all these like the ranking, but there's no way, even if your job is like to be a college basketball writer, you can't possibly watch enough basketball to accurately
just no way.
You maybe watch each team like once or twice a year, and that's such a small sample size.
Well, you know which ones to pay attention to inherently, because they're like teams like North Carolina or something that it's like, you know, they're going to be a contender or whatever, so you pay attention to those.
Right
But yeah, I it's impossible. And I went to USC, and I didn't go to any of their basketball games, which I should have.
Yeah, but y'all weren't good.
No. We got into the tournament that at some point during the 4 years I was there, mm-hmm. we like got in the first round and then I think we lost in the second round uh-huh. or something. Yeah. But, and I didn't even go to the football games.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I, season tickets for students were like $300.
Okay.
And,
yeah, yeah.
I just didn't have cash on hand to spend on that. I yeah, was yeah, like, yeah. I had a very limited tuition was enough. I had a very limited funds.
Right.
I just didn't, it didn't make sense. I was like, I don't think I'm going to do that. So I went to one football game. It was the first, it was the season opener my freshman year versus the Buckeyes. And okay. they billed it as like, it's going to be the Super Bowl of college football this year.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just destroyed them for mm-hmm. like 3 hours. And I bought like a $40 general admission ticket. So I couldn't even go in the student section. So I was like, by myself with like other rich students who had like bought specific tickets. I just remember like we scored and the guy next to me turned to all his friends to high five them and then turned to me by accident to high five me. And we like high fived and then he kind of stared at me like, who are you? And so I just kind of weirdly watched this game by myself and then never went to another one.
Nice, nice.
But yeah, anyway, it's hard to follow.
Yeah. And I imagine like I would imagine there's an even a current element of that. I imagine with people who are currently actively religious, even people who like maybe go to church more than like twice a year, who go yeah. like once a month. There's a lot to follow. I mean,
yeah.
if you want to like quote unquote do Christianity, right? There's a lot of passages. There's a lot of books. There's a yeah. lot of like little sub stories that
it's a lot.
Yeah.
But back to what you were talking about, I do think, yeah, I think the tradition used to be if you were someone who's kind of atheistic or skewing that way, didn't totally find meaning in whatever God you were being served.
Mm-hmm.
I think you went to church.
Right.
And then you did nothing else, yeah. you know, like you did your like any of the public trappings of Christianity or whatever, you participated in that. And then, you know, at home you were a man of science.
Right. Which is why, like, and I remember even like growing up in the South, even fucking 20, 30 years ago, like it was a bigger deal to be an atheist then, like it mm-hmm. would have been bringing attention to yourself to have yes. been openly atheist.
Yeah.
And like I sometimes roll my eyes at people who are like, you know, staunchly militantly atheist because they can annoy
me. Oh
my
God, the worst.
But I also can get it because if you grew up in an oppressive, yeah. you know, in any kind of oppressive environment,
100%,
your spirit is yearning to be free yes. and to call out the bullshit yes, exactly. that you had to live with.
Because so much of it is bullshit. And my girlfriend and I were just talking about this the other day. It's because we were, she was kind of similarly like, these militant atheists are so hardcore. They're just hardcore in the other way. That's not like a mm-hmm. bold statement to say that, but they're so hard. They're just hardcore in another way. And, you know, my point on that is exactly that. It's purely people who are that way are reactionary.
Right.
They're reacting to, I think in general, those are people who have been, like you said, grew up in a restrictive environment so that their atheism is less about like, I genuinely don't believe there's a God and I don't like these, you know, and I don't find meaning in that kind of spirituality and right. more about like religion is evil. It fucked me up, you mm-hmm. know, and like I want to make sure it doesn't mess up anyone else that I like know or care about.
Right.
And I want to fight against it because organized religion, and this is what my girlfriend and I were trying to decide, is organized religion the most destructive human-made force in human history?
Yeah, man.
And I think you can, if you're being sort of brutally honest and, you know, I think the net, just on death count, I feel like it comes down on net negative.
Yeah, yeah. You know? It's got to be that or government, right? One
yes.
or the other.
yeah, know? Exactly.
This
yeah.
is where we turn into an Alex Jones yeah. podcast.
yeah, exactly. Follow the truth. Government would be the contender, right?
Yeah.
Those would be the two that you would decide.
Right, especially because, this is where it gets tough to judge the stats, is because
100%.
they were just intertwined for so long. Like, how do you,
yeah, exactly.
with like the Crusades, how do you even chalk one up to one or the other? There?
Yeah, those are so, it's a religious government. It's a theocratic society
right.
going to war on religious principles.
Right.
Hey, which we're still doing, but yeah, I guess they are so intertwined that maybe it probably would be unfair of me to just flat out say straight up religion,
right?
Because actually, government would be more widespread and longer lasting. Because kind of every, mm-hmm. I mean, when you just use the broad umbrella term of government, every place on earth has some form of government,
right?
Of some kind.
Just that there's a tribal council,
exactly.
Or
anything.
But I don't mean specifically a Survivor.
Survivor, sure. The government on Survivor Island, the government of Temptation Island. These are places with, you know, tribunals.
I mean, it's pretty brutal. They kill off somebody once a week.
Yes, but you know, it's only through extinguishing their flame, and then and they're able to return. You know?
It's kind of a metaphor for government. Just yeah. One by one, they just kill off, and then all of a sudden they have nobody to rule over.
Yeah, and then your empire falls apart,
and you win $1 million.
Yeah, so I guess government probably would be on top technically, but I think they're the same.
Well, here's where like I stop, or I get like. You know, I'm becoming a religious apologist, I guess.
But, sure.
Like, okay, it's not even about being defending religion as it is so much maybe indicting human nature. Because,
absolutely.
Like, we all know the tropes of power corrupting, absolutely, blah, blah, blah. And, like, but it's true. Like, and, like, sociopaths will use whatever structures are available.
100%.
To achieve whatever power, to inflict whatever damage they want for their own selfish means. And so, in that sense, religion just being such a common and huge one,
mm-hmm.
of course there's going to be sociopaths that rise to the top yeah. of that, just as there are for any power structure.
And for government, yeah, it's a system, it's a structure, and people are bad.
When you're talking about anything on that scale,
yeah.
whether it's a cultural-wide movement like a religion or, I guess, a cultural-wide, encompassing system or
yeah.
organizational system that's government, that's just, you're scaling up human greed
yes, exactly.
to an insane
yeah,
level.
You're able to become Silvio Berlusconi or somebody
right.
and just be this creepy monster.
I mean, yeah. like, you know, governments and religions let, they let human corruption go viral
yes.
pre-internet.
Yes, exactly. You know? Yeah, and, I think there's a specific breed of atheist, like Western American and European atheists that are pretty directly tied to being a response to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's kind of like, I think the Catholic Church has done the most in terms of putting up getting people interested in atheism.
yeah, yeah.
Now, you know, just because they have such a kind of concrete history that I feel like is pretty objective fact of just kind of,
mm-hmm.
A lot of destruction, a lot of exploitation, a lot of abuse.
Not to bring it back into college basketball, but
let's
Duke,
do it.
But you know, the Duke UNC rivalry has been. if it wasn't for Duke, there would be way less UNC fans.
100, yeah, I know? Think that's right. Absolutely.
when you have this an evil force like that in the world,
yeah.
you know, you naturally there's a natural human inclination yeah, to fight that
to
power.
Go the other way. Right. Yeah, yeah, and I think the aspect of, I mean, obviously all those things about Catholicism disturb me. I think what also kind of gets to me about it is the opulence of it, mm. of it all. Like when I went to Europe when I was like 14 and my family did a big trip of like 12 countries, mm-hmm. you know? And so you go to like 1,000 cathedrals.
Right.
Cause that's just like where yeah. everywhere.
They're
you know?
Everywhere.
I've yeah. seen like so many. And being raised non-religious, I hadn't seen a lot of the like quote unquote deeper cuts of like religious imagery, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like I was not aware of Saint Francis is the one who like got shot full of arrows, I think.
Oh wow. I didn't
and,
know that.
I think that's right.
Somebody did.
Someone out
did.
There is pulling their hair
okay,
out.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, but some saint was shot full of arrows. And so I must have seen like 100 portraits of this guy shot full of arrows.
Wow.
And all that stuff. But you would just go in these cathedrals that are enormous
right.
and everything is just covered in gold.
Right.
And it's still so awe-inspiring and spiritual and exciting and interesting. You know, it's a really powerful atmosphere in those places.
Mm-hmm.
Still, in our modern context. So I can't even imagine what it would have been like for some serf to be like right. wandering into the city for the first time. And then there's this man in a golden suit standing yeah. at this high podium in this incredible like palace.
Right. Yeah.
Being like, I know what's up, you know?
Yeah. Well, and like, you know, it still blows me away. Like I was in New York last summer and went to a handful of the cathedrals mm-hmm. there, which are also, you know, equally as massive as some of the ones in Europe. And it's, you know, I have the internet. I have things that like, I yes. know how things are made.
Yes.
I've seen how things are made.
Yeah. I've watched the show, How Things Are Made.
I'm familiar. But like, even just being like, how the fuck did this get made?
I totally.
You know?
Especially for, well, you look at any of those like old religious structures that are still so enormous and monumental.
Yeah.
There's like, wow, so many people got hurt.
And again, like,
this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's right. Right. Anytime you're like, how did the pyramids get made? Oh, right. Slavery.
Slaves.
Right.
Okay. Slaves did that.
Cool. Yeah. Cool.
But yeah, so I think that's where a lot of atheism comes from. I think especially like sexual abuse in the Catholic Church kind of reinvigorated a lot of that in the back half of the 20th century here in America.
Mm-hmm.
What I was going to say, I hate atheists a lot who are like hardcore that okay. way.
Yeah.
I have empathy for them if it is reactionary from their own experience.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this breed that I don't think have like the real experience of mm-hmm. being like a kid in the South who like, you know, is maybe like a little queer or just a little like open-minded in a couple different ways than is presented to them by
right.
their religion and, you know, grow up oppressed in that way.
Right.
But then I think there's this class of like rich white dude assholes.
Mm.
Basically, mm-hmm. The people in my mind are Ricky Gervais and Bill Maher.
Yeah.
And
yeah. It's about like a superiority complex thing.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very like I know everything. It's very certain.
Right.
And that's the thing about it that pisses me off the most. I think it's mm-hmm. total, like, I come down on the side of rejecting this a structure of organized religion because that's not something that is meaningful to me.
Right.
Because there's no tradition for it in my experience. And I'm kind of a practical, logic-based, you know, scholarly dude,
yeah.
In a sense, was raised to be anyway. So that doesn't hold meaning for me. But I wouldn't ever claim to know 100% that there was not, you know, to use the tried and true phrase of a higher power, but
right.
just any kind of something, any kind of force or whatever. The idea of claiming certainty on any side of that debate as one individual person, especially as like just some fucking idiot comedian, like,
right.
how would I know?
Hey, we're modern day philosophers, man.
Troubadours. That gets to like one of my biggest pet peeves with comedians is when they call non-comedians civilians. I think that's like the most disgusting thing in the world.
I've definitely been guilty of that.
Me too. I really stopped after my brother joined the army because I explained to him once when he was in basic training. We were like on a phone call or something, and I was like, you know, Austin, a lot of stand-ups call non-stand-ups civilians. And he laughed so hard, and he just finally, when he stopped laughing, he was just like, why? What have you done? Like, where have you served?
I mean, God, you know? It's so funny picturing, like, you know, just like a group of comics at the Comedy Store, like,
exactly.
getting ready, like, trying to mentally prepare in the same way that
it's
they're, like a soldier is so offensive.
It's really offensive. But I get why they're trying to make a distinction because it is a completely different lifestyle.
Yes.
And to a big degree, a different worldview.
Yes.
But
yes.
The idea of saying full stop civilian. And I was also because I'm like reading Bruce Springsteen's autobiography and I'm noticing a lot of like parallels between musician process and comedian process, of course, because they're both like, you know, creative fields in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think musicians are guilty of saying civilians.
No.
Musicians.
Also, there's way more likelihood for collateral damage in comedy to actually wound your audience
yeah,
members. So
100%.
I wouldn't even know how much of civilian they're in the battlefield of terrible jokes.
Oh my God.
Just as much as anybody.
It's so horrible. But yeah, literally just imagining like a bunch of fat white guys at that table at the back of the comedy store being like, see, civilians don't get it, bro.
But that's such a defense, common defense mechanism for like younger comics.
It's
especially.
So weird. But anyway, I think all of that was to talk about the certainty of that kind of atheism.
Yeah.
I just see that that Bill Maher, Ricky Gervais shit, and I'm just like, I wish that they would come out a little more. I mean, I guess I just want them to think like I think, which is just appreciating a little more. Okay, so you're a science-based person. You know, you're someone who that's part of your argument against religion. How about the mysteries of science?
Exactly.
They're insane.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you in that I really wish people would accept mystery in general, or would accept, be comfortable with not knowing, be comfortable with.
Yeah.
There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of chaos and randomness. I mean, I guess this is where. You know, and I hate, I really get annoyed with, obviously like evangelical Christians, just as much who are saying everybody's going to hell, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, this is the common, I guess, sympathetic point that people talk about that I guess I come around on. And maybe it's the same with some militant atheists. It's like, if that person legitimately believes that's the truth, then it's almost their duty. Like, it would almost be immoral not to be if you were like 100% certain that there was no God, it would almost be immoral to not try to convince people of it. Or if you were 100% certain that everybody was going to hell that didn't, you know, profess Jesus to be their literal Lord and Savior as a literal son of God, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's almost like, oh, it's my duty to try to save these. I don't want people to go to hell. I would be an asshole if I didn't try.
Yeah, and that throws me, because anyone who thinks it's their duty to make people think anything is kind of... I guess that's not totally true in terms of maybe like causes I believe in. I guess part of me is
murky,
it's very murky. I guess part of me would say like we're recording this the day after a bunch of protests for against gun violence and for gun control.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I believe in a lot. So I guess, you know, you could kind of say that I feel some degree of duty to, you know, get that point, represent that point of view, articulate that point of view.
Right.
But anything that's like really hardcore forcing people to believe something.
Right.
Something like gun control is a little more like legislative, practical, you know, I don't want to die at the grocery store kind of thought, you know.
You want to know, hear a cool quote on protesting I heard the other day.
Yeah.
Do you know who Ram Dass is?
Sure. Like,
yeah. So this is something from Be Here Now. I was just like flipping through random pages in Be Here Now. And I came to this thing, and I'm going to butcher it, but you can Google a more accurate version of this quote to get a more eloquent version of it. It's something like, for a protest to be effective, you have to love the person whose ideas you hate as much as like you love yourself.
Yeah.
Which is so, when I read that, I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. Just radical empathy. And I do find, that's also really tricky too, because like, to pull another quote from a Titan, The Rock. The Rock had an Instagram post yesterday in response to these protests that was so carefully worded.
Mm.
It like threaded the needle so expertly to like not come down too much like I'm with these kids and down too much like I think people should be allowed to have guns.
Yeah.
It was really like right down the middle, and it included some line about like, that really pissed me off. It was like, I hope this one-way demonstration can lead to some great two-way conversation.
Wow. Well, you know what? I'll have some empathy for The Rock here, because why not?
Sure. Why not? He's a, who cares?
I mean, imagine like, he has to have like a fan base that is a weird mix of like, I mean, it's probably mostly, I would guess, it's a lot of people from wrestling days that are mostly conservative a lot of action hero type
fans.
Yeah,
well, he's the biggest movie star in the world.
Right.
So he has to cater to the entire world.
Right.
And specifically, like, all of America.
Right. Because
he's based in America. So I don't begrudge him saying that.
And he's running for president.
Yeah, and, that's kind of, my buddies, like, I saw it because I'm on a text chain with some old roommates that we said that to each other, being like, is he fucking running for president? But that, it irritated me a little bit because... But I also understand it a little bit of like, I think it's bogus to kind of play that card
yeah.
with something as dramatic and intense as gun violence to be like, hey, like we gotta, you know, we gotta talk, we gotta, but that's true. It's like, we do have to take, we do have to talk and compromise and take victories one step at a time. Like, you know, if it's just getting bump stocks banned,
right?
Like that's not satisfying enough to me at all.
No,
but I need to accept that as like a really positive step and not, not still just be screaming the entire time of like, this isn't enough. Although I am glad people are out there screaming that.
Right, right.
But, you know, so that's such a murky area too of like, it is important to have what Ram Dass is talking about, that radical empathy of really, I think that's essential.
Especially, I mean, and it's like, you know, especially when talking about like effective protests, because it's so much of like, I mean, I was so moved yet by the protest yesterday, especially Emma Gonzalez's like 6 minute moment of silence.
Yeah, that was great.
I saw that. That was
a lot of great speeches.
Very, very chilling. But then I did think, I'm like, man, as moving as this is for me and powerful, and I know a lot of other people who maybe are on the fence will be moved positively by this. There's going to be a lot of people who are turned off by this and who feel attacked by this. And I just, you know, it's something we've talked about ad nauseum, but it's like the polarization of today's political environment. Yeah. It's just so, we just seem to get further and further entrenched the more and more we label each other as enemies and others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's, you know, this is another, this is my other big defense of religion, where like maybe apology for religion or what I miss about it is that I feel like when there was a more, now we had the bad of people not being able to be openly atheists, as we've been talking about, but like when everybody was Christian or assumed Christian, it would kind of, or like assumed one single religion, there was almost, I think it was easier for politics to not be so polarized, because you could say like, well, at the end of the day, you know, I know we believe in the same God, or I know we are both on the same page. And maybe that's, you know, you have a totally different experience than me.
Well,
that,
no, I,
but that's
I,
what I felt.
I think that's true, but I think the grounding of that is a little sinister in the sense of
I think
that was the case because so many disenfranchised groups didn't have a mainstream voice.
Absolutely. That's
so
yeah,
the mainstream.
It's very similar to me being like, you know, back in the good old days when you know, we had good segregation.
Exactly. That's why people think the 1950s are the good old days, is because what was on TV and like the pictures we see of it so much are the good old days.
Right.
Because no one was photographing police brutality in black neighborhoods.
Well, you know? Right.
Like it's no one was making that TV show until that civil rights movement.
Well, I was even watching, not to get too sidetracked on that, but like I was watching, there's a, I think Netflix just either recently, I don't know. I don't think they made it. I think it's a National Geographic thing on the 92 LA riots, Rodney King riots. But they showed like the lead up to that, like the preface to it was the Watts riots in the 60s, and how back then was like, that was almost some of the first time that, I guess, I guess it was in the middle of the civil rights movement, but it was the first time specifically police brutality and unfairness, beyond just general unfairness and other shitty things that have been happening to African Americans, but like it almost was like breaking people. Like I imagine to a lot of people, they would have like just not believed that. And people still don't believe it.
Yeah, I know.
People still don't believe it.
Yeah. And that's all, not believing it now, it gets more twisted.
Yeah.
Because it's like, really? You haven't seen any of the evidence of this?
You haven't seen anything?
You haven't seen anything? But yeah, like a random like white suburban father of four in like 1965, you know, understandable that they might not have been aware or might not have accepted.
Right.
Not positive, but understandable. But yeah, it's the idea of not getting it now is kind of like, ooh.
I guess what I'm like, maybe what I'm yearning for, maybe what I would hope that we can do, and what I almost felt like, you know, maybe my 90s are the good old days now. Like,
yes, sure.
There was also some level of maybe willful ignorance of some of these issues, but like, you know, that seemed like, I would like, there, you know, we have to move past our old models of religion because we're never going to go back. We need to move past literalist and fundamentalist interpretations of religion.
I agree.
So how do we, you know, in order for us to have this, not just effective protest, but effective dialogue and communication, and for like progress to really be made where we say, all right, let me actually try to understand your point of view.
Yeah.
and vice versa. There does, I feel like there does need to be some more common cultural ground, but I just see us becoming more and more two different Americas these days.
Yeah, and you know, who the hell knows what the solution is to that? But
I got it.
Do you? Okay, yeah, great. Yeah, we'll drop that in. you got a link to your website with your manifesto.
Can you imagine just like 10 pages?
That says, kill all the Puerto Ricans. What is this? No, but this gets to something that I wanted to talk about, which is, yeah, I think, which is tolerance and for people on kind of my quote-unquote side of the more sort of atheist, like liberal progressive political side.
Like the right side.
The correct side. I think we could absolutely stand to not be so dismissive of the side that we disagree with. You know, that's not radical to say, but in specifically in the context of religion, so I grew up in Seattle, and I think that's a big part of why that's a piece of my overall non-religious upbringing that's an environment where there were a lot of people like me, I think. I think there were a lot of families who weren't really raised with any religious tradition or like very mild religious traditions of like my high school girlfriend would go to Christmas Eve mass, you know, and like was briefly in a youth group or something, you know, like a lot of like youth groups that go on hikes. That's kind of like a lot of people doing that. But then also I had a lot of friends who were Reform Jews. And so that's a very kind of like casual dip your toe in as you want religious experience.
Sure. Yeah.
That's very easy to just sort of integrate into whatever you want your life to be. So I was seeing a lot of, you know, atheist or atheist adjacent, a lot of kind of casual religion at most. And so that was sort of the norm. So it was totally accepted. And, you know, a very liberal place. Everyone kind of thinks the same way. You know, like every kid in my middle school was like hardcore against the Iraq war, shit like that.
Yeah.
In that context, and I saw it here since moving to Los Angeles, living here for like 9 years, you do really see the dismissal and people painting Christians as just like Southern hick rednecks,
right.
Bible thumping, like idiots,
right.
You know, who are like inbred more, you know, there is a harshness in language and stereotyping of Christians from some liberals. Now, I don't think it's nearly as like pandemic as Fox News
war
wants
on
to be.
Christmas.
Yeah, like that's such bullshit. It's crazy.
White men are a persecuted class.
The war on Christmas is one of the crazier myths to try to perpetrate, just because like every year one or two businesses bother to like try to include some more people,
right?
And then that's all you need to be like, what? They're calling it a holiday tree, and I'm like, yeah, okay, who cares?
It's war on Christian hegemony.
Yeah. It's like all we get of media wise about Christmas for like 2 months straight, we just get Christmas rammed down our throats every single place we go.
Yeah.
So the idea of that is insane. But I think there is I don't think it's persecution, but I think there's a kind of snide superiority, you know, and it's people's main criticism about liberals or atheists or whatever. Right. There's this sense of, you know, I know better and these people who disagree with me are dumb.
Yeah.
And to that, it's like, you haven't met dumb liberals? I don't know. Like, I feel like now, I feel like I know so many people who just like post such dumb bullshit on Facebook. And you're like, you're so wrong, even though you're right.
And I don't have the time to break this down.
Yeah, and nor should I. I actually even thought that about one, and this is like maybe mean to say, but you know, they've been interviewing a lot of teenagers about this gun violence stuff, at marches and stuff. And it's funny to hear some of them talk, and they're firmly anti-gun. But when they're kind of asked a simple question, sort of about like, why do you believe this about guns or whatever? they have a hard time kind of stringing together like a complete coherent sentence as to why they are against guns. Not all of them. Some of them are like really astounding. Some like you're saying, Emma Gonzalez is such a gifted speaker. It's like so mind blowing that it's like, God, you're 18. You're like this good at crafting a speech and a logical argument that's really hard to dismiss. But some of these, you hear some of these kids just kind of give a run on sentence that, and it makes me go like, yeah, okay, you're someone who's not 100% informed and you're on this like side that I agree with,
right?
But you're 16, you don't have all the tools to like articulate this yet, but glad you're on the right side.
That actually reminds me of a bit Steve Hernandez used to do about like when you were at a party and somebody, or at a group and somebody who was on your side started arguing, and you just made you question your own beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely. When someone just like 20% different from you, or like 20% worse at explaining something, and you're just like, oh God,
do I believe this?
That's really good.
Yeah.
I think that empathy that you're talking about is important. And it's just hard because it's like, especially in these times when the stakes are so high, and that like the other side is being like, yeah, transgender people shouldn't exist.
Right.
It's hard to be like, well, let's talk about this. You know, you want to exactly. protect a firm boundary and a firm red line for yourself.
Totally. And you know, there's like, this is my like, you know, ultra, I hate hippies. Like I'm not even really a hippie, but like, you know, this is my new agey sort of take on shit. But like, I feel that we as a collective are all manifesting what you might call God, or you know, this collective of unconsciousness as spirit, and like all our individual task is to do is to honestly articulate our personal point of view. And so in that way, we're kind of like one pixel on a larger screen, like a larger LED, like a giant fucking billion pixel super high def.
Hell yeah, dude. 4K? Is this thing 4K?
4K, baby.
Hell yeah, dude.
And so like we can't be responsible for how the entire picture ends up looking, but we have to articulate what we honestly believe. And so in that sense, even people who are like much more angry than I am, or have less room for empathy because they're like, hey, you want me to be empathetic? My fucking brother got shot in like a school, motherfucker.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what pain have you suffered like
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
You know, and so I can't fault anybody for doing that. And we all need to be, and even my people who completely disagree with me, I need them to honestly articulate their point of view, because there's a lot, this is the challenging and tough one for me. This is the one of the roadblocks to gun control I struggle with. Because I'm like pro legalization of a lot of stuff, like with as far as like drug laws, because I see how black markets don't work,
right?
Or they, you know, outlawing stuff means they just criminals get enriched, and this whatever you're trying to ban ultimately still exists, and more dangers created.
Yeah,
and it's tough for me to be like, yeah, I can't. You know, if we ban, how do we pack in Pandora's box at this point with
yes.
guns?
Yeah, you know? I think that's a totally legit stumbling block. And I'd be surprised if we ever saw guns like truly outlawed in the United States. I just don't think we have the culture for it.
Yeah.
I could see a world where we end up going back to restricting those assault weapons and you know, scaling that stuff back. But yeah, I mean, if you have that kind of a vaguely libertarian bent in some of your ideas, it is troubling to kind of be like, oh, so I'm not allowed the agency that comes with owning a weapon.
Right.
Personally, I would never want a gun in my house at all. But but this let's talk about new agey shit.
Now we're
in this new age space, because that was a very nice new age imagery. So your background, which I'm slightly familiar with, but you grew up religious and now you are not as much in that tradition.
Well, this is you know, it's complicated.
Yeah.
But my dad is a Presbyterian minister, and so grew up super religious. But like, Presbyterians are pretty chill Christians, as far as like, you know, women have been ministers for over 50 years, and like,
that's nice.
My dad's married gay people before, and so like, it's
great.
Pretty so as far as like having to grow up Christian, I really did luck out. And Presbyterians are pro education, very like pro discernment, intelligent, and not necessarily all literalist interpretations of the Bible. So
great.
That's all great. I went through a phase in college where I started studying the Bible, like in courses, like I took an Old Testament class and New Testament class and been like, oh man, I don't know why I believe, I've always just believed this, but I don't necessarily have like a good logical reason for thinking that why all these independent sources that I realize now comprise the Bible, like all these independent authors that were edited for political reasons, blah, blah, blah.
Right. The story of the Bible is so insane.
Right. So that made me lose Christianity. I was pretty strongly atheist and then agnostic for a while. And I mean, maybe agnostic I'm somewhere between agnostic and like pantheist now where
cool.
I'm like pantheistically agnostic, hell I guess. Yeah. Cause I've come back around. I mean, and like a lot of other, white dudes who did a good amount of, smoked a good amount of weed.
Yeah, absolutely,
I got into like Eastern religion and stuff. Yeah. And I still am into that. And like, but now I've come around on Christianity a lot, and I feel like I see at least how it fits in a larger collage of
and this gets into that empathy thing that we were talking about. Like, really, atheists, you don't understand why someone would want religion in their life. Like, you don't understand like people seeking comfort in this like howling wilderness that we all live in. Like,
well, this is this is what I kind of feel that most, I really do feel like most religions originated with good intentions, and that, in terms of like the original people, the prophets and the mystics of every religion were like essentially, I think, trying to capture, not, this sounds like, to people who have never done psychedelics, it sounds like I'm about to diminish it or like shit on religion, or like make it sound lame. Yeah, you think you already kind of know where I'm going.
Whatever. I've done plenty of psychedelics. So.
But like, the same feelings that you feel on mushrooms, trying to communicate that and discipline your life so that you can regularly come into contact with those same realizations.
Yeah.
In a group setting, and that you're constantly trying to be reminded of, like, oh, right, I believe we are all one, therefore I'm going to follow the Ten Commandments because I believe we should all be treating each other as complete equals with zero status. Maybe the Ten Commandments aren't a great example, but like,
sure,
I can follow Jesus' teachings.
A structure, yeah.
Essentially, Jesus was saying that like, we are all the same. There is no, like, all power structure is bullshit, and like, it's, we're all from the same source, blah, blah, blah. I summed up the Bible.
Right, the latest piece that kind of gets this, like what you're describing in terms of like that, a Presbyterian, like more kind of chill Christian thing. I don't know if you watched Queer Eye at all.
I still haven't seen the reboot.
It's a delight.
Yeah.
I'm not a reality show guy, so this is the first one I've watched in maybe a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's got a lot of the annoying trappings of a reality show.
It has like a some Atlanta.
Oh my God,
comedian,
dude.
There, right?
The episode they do where they make over a comic was like the darkest hour of television I've ever watched. It was so bleak and brutal. It made me like want to quit comedy because it's like these two brothers in Atlanta who seem like just like middling kind of comedy talents. No offense, guys, but
is it the best or worst thing for their career?
Yeah, exactly. And like,
soon to tell.
There's this beat in the middle where the Fab Five guys like surprise the guy they're making over with, "We got you a gig to like do some stuff," and it's just like, like an afternoon at like a VFW hall with like a bunch of people doing other shit in the VFW hall, and then suddenly they like make him stand up and do his like terrible open mic set, and I was I was watching it through closed hands. I couldn't handle it. So that, skip that episode.
I'm definitely watching that episode.
It's so dark
watching,
dude,
that shit, man.
Plus what's really crazy about that one is he lives with his parents. He lives like in the room next to his parents, and then their big makeover is they remodel the basement so that he has like a nice basement apartment.
So sad.
And I'm like, these parents must be pissed. they're like, great, so now he'll never leave our goddamn house. Anyway, there's a very nice episode with this Christian family where it's this very kind of sweet dad is the guy they make over, and he's got like I think he has a ton of kids, like 7 or 8 kids or something. So it's just this like totally overworked, exhausted dad. And that's kind of what the whole episode is about. And then suddenly when he like is saying goodbye to them at the end, he has this like gorgeous, like Coach Taylor-esque like monologue where he's just like, this was such a valuable experience. Thank you so much. What I'm really happy. We, we talked, me and my wife talked a lot about, like, did we want to do this? And we decided we really wanted to do this to basically to show our daughters that, like, gay people are people who deserve our love and respect.
Wow.
You know, not that, not that their daughters, like, didn't think that, but they just, like, really wanted to show them and show themselves, you know, like, hey, here's this world of, it was just such a beautiful moment. And
that's cool.
It's the kind of moment that makes me want to, like, I want to show hardcore atheists something like that and be like, so what's wrong with these people being Christian? There's, like, absolutely nothing wrong with,
yeah,
if you're this open heart, open-minded and open-hearted and, like, loving and just driving towards love, then who cares that part of that is a nice prayer on a Sunday?
Yeah, like, you know? Exactly. Like, and maybe those atheists should invite some Christians to, like, teach them how to sing or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah, exactly. I'm
trying to think of the equivalent there.
But in New Age stuff, New Age stuff gets into the only thing anywhere close to a religious practice that I currently have.
Okay.
Which is, for about 8 or 9 months now, I have been practicing transcendental meditation.
Okay, cool,
yes,
man.
So that's something that I've arrived at recently.
I would love to. Nobody's really talked to me at length about that. So, like, from what I understand, there that involves a mantra. Mm-hmm. It's a meditation style where you have, a mantra where it's, which is like, it's like a phrase, right? And yep. you specifically, you get your own.
You are assigned a mantra.
Okay.
And then you cannot.
You can't tell me
share
what it is.
So I can't tell you what it is.
All right.
Although I recently listened to.
Can you say rhymes with?
Well. I won't, but I recently listened to Marc Maron's interview with Jennifer Lawrence,
okay,
and they talk about stuff like this, and she's like, yeah, I tried TM for like a minute. I couldn't do it. And he's like, oh, they give you a mantra or whatever, and you can't tell me what. And she goes like, yeah, but it sounded like my mantra. It sounded like, and she like says what her mantra sounded like. And as soon as she said it, I was like, fucking Jennifer Lawrence has my mantra. It's like, okay. It really sucked to like hear it out loud.
Oh, no.
But there's like, the way it all works is there's, you, or at least the way it works in Los Angeles, the way you have to do it in America is, you have to be taught at a transcendental meditation center. There's an official like transcendental meditation foundation,
okay,
that, and they have, schools all over the world, but specifically all over the United States as well. And, you go and you sign up for, in my case, I did a 4-day class,
okay,
which is like 2 hours a day for 4 days.
Wow.
You go to the center. So it's not even like that. It's a commitment, but it's not that commitment. It's a little pricey, but there's a sliding pay scale for that instruction.
Okay.
So you can pay as, I think the lowest you can pay for the Los Feliz one that I went to is like maybe $700 or
something.
So it's a little pricier.
Mm-hmm.
But
can you put a price on changing your life?
Hey, that's what I'm saying.
Yes, I mean, but seriously.
$700. But it was, and so then what you do on the first day of that class, you is a one-on-one,
mm-hmm,
where you and your instructor just go to this like little room and you do a little ceremony,
mm-hmm,
where you, and I won't go into all the details of the ceremony because you should do it. But yeah, it's basically you kind of make a little offering. You, kind of sing/chant a little bit. There's a picture of the Maharishi there.
Okay.
And then you meditate with your instructor, and they assign you a mantra, and the mantras come from a set of mantras. So it's not just something they like make up or
right.
There's a set of, I don't know how many, but a few mantras. So definitely people have the same mantra, but I think, and I don't know this for sure, but I think they might kind of, I think they're supposed to be kind of like a resonant sound. Although you don't repeat it out loud, you just kind of hold it in your mind.
Okay.
But I think they kind of assign specific ones to you based on like your height and weight is my guess.
Really?
Yeah, I think there's something to like the resonance of it. That's my like weird armchair quarterback idea so about how it works.
Yeah, so it's like...
so that might be totally
it's
wrong.
It's like the NFL draft like pro days where they're just like the combine.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the combine. They size you up and they go, oh, all right, you're this mantra guy. and then after that, you... practice it 20 minutes a day, twice a day, 20 minutes twice a day.
Okay.
Usually like morning, afternoon is kind of what they suggest. And I found it to be a real low-key, accessible form of meditation because it's not dismissive of thought. You're not trying to, it's not mindfulness, which is when you focus on the breath or focus on the flame of a candle or something.
Right.
It's one where you kind of hold your mantra in your mind, not even necessarily repeating it in your mind, just sort of thinking it there like a thought. And then you allow other thoughts to come in.
Okay.
And then as soon as you are aware of the fact, oh, I am not holding the mantra in my head. I am on a train of thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you kind of just quietly slide back to the holding mantra. The mantra in your
right.
head.
And then without judgment.
Exactly.
Right.
They specifically say, there's no bad way to do this. And even my instructor was like, I've been doing this since I was a child. He was like raised doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, and I'll still have meditations that are like 90% my own thoughts and like 10%. Oh, I got to settle back into the mantra. So that was like, I was like, I could do that. So, and that's kind of what it's been for me a little bit is just like a relaxing break twice a day. Just a chance to like be away from, it's kind of just a little unplug.
And have you noticed like, you know, any changes in...
See, this is something, and this is part of what's weird. I don't think I've noticed any like, there are no big dramatic banner changes that I can point to.
Right.
Even like in this last year, I've had some kind of like career-y success, which is something that some people like assign to TM stuff. But a lot of those were wheels that were in motion before I started TM.
Right.
So I'm kind of like, well, I can't really credit that. I think the effects that I've noticed are at different times, it's helped me have more energy and just feel a little more kind of awake and slightly more present in some settings, you know? But that kind of can come and go. And I think it has helped me become a little aware of my own thoughts a little more just to kind of make myself take a bit more of a break. And I do feel like I've done a little bit of kind of personal growth in terms of like, I don't know, bad habits that I have in terms of like negative trains of thought that I find myself in again and again. I feel like I'm a little more aware of them now. So it's not like I don't have them anymore. I definitely do.
Right.
But I think I'm able to step out of myself a little bit more. I find that a little bit in my relationship too, is I'm able to, you know, if my girlfriend kind of brings up something that I'm doing that isn't very positive for the relationship, I still get defensive. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
But I can tell, I'm kind of outside my body going like, you're being defensive right now because she's right.
Well, it's like something that I want to say I've heard Tara Brach talk about, who's a Buddhist teacher. She has an awesome, she has a podcast, and then like all her lectures are on YouTube, whatever. But like she does guided meditations, and she talks about meditation a lot. And I want to say she was one talking about this, but you know, there's three essentially ways we can relate to stimuli, and meditation helps us with each step of this. So like the base level one, when I'm not meditating, which is currently I'm not super, super bad on my meditation practice. I mean, I'm a mindfulness guy.
Got it. Yeah.
I'm in team mindfulness.
Yeah. there's another UNC Duke rivalry. Mindfulness versus TM, dude.
I mean, some people probably do take it that seriously.
Probably, yeah.
But so like the first level is you react, which is what you're talking about, which is the mindless reaction is what most people who don't ever practice any kind of meditation or mindfulness, and I get more like that the less I do it, which is something happens and you act without thinking without any kind of discernment. And then the next level is respond, which is what kind of I'm hearing you're describing, which is like, okay, I'm still maybe internally reacting, but I'm aware of my reaction, and then I'm consciously choosing how to respond in a mindful way, which is usually a more skillful way. Although sometimes I struggle with this, especially as it relates to like, you know, maybe doing comedy or something where it's like, or maybe improv, or like, I sometimes wonder, I'm like, does it make me more self-conscious in certain situations where versus where I want to kind of be reactionary and be in the zone or whatever.
Yeah.
Or like, but that's a whole other,
I hear that.
It's a whole other kind of ball of wax for dealing with people. And like at work, responding is almost always better than reacting.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
And then the third one is being like proactive. So it's like even beyond like I'm noticing these bad things, and like it's the like, okay, I'm now that I'm noticing these, what's positive, you know, active steps can I take changing my behavior or whatever?
Yeah, there's a little more agency in that way. Like, we my girlfriend and I will have like little squabbles. This is sort of our pattern now, and I don't know that this is just related to DM, but like overall, we I don't want to make it sound like we fight all the time. We have a very positive relationship.
I think if you call it a squabble.
Yeah, it's a squabble. It's some kind of little domestic annoyance, whatever. I feel like our pattern now is we'll have one of those where we're a little bit kind of, you know, butting heads for like 10 minutes, and then we'll just sort of like walk away for a second and then like meet again in the living room in like 15 minutes. And we're both just like, I'm so sorry.
Oh, you know, it's beautiful, man.
It's very nice.
That's nice.
But I think some of that is due to the awareness of my own thoughts that TM has given me, because kind of as soon as we separate, I'm able to stand there going like, yeah, why did you say that thing? That was a really dumb thing that you said, you know, but you kind of can't in the moment. But when I first took the TM class, like by day four, you know, we're checking in with everybody like every day. You'd go around and say like, how was meditation today? Like, but in those first 4 days, you're trying it for the first time. And like, people were crazy. People in my class were like, one woman was saying, like, who had walked in with a cane on the first day was saying like, my knee is healing, you know? And like, one woman said like her blood pressure, or like her, she has diabetes and like her counts were better on like day four or whatever. I mean, which there is a lot of hard medical data about TM as a kind of like a proactive, preemptive treatment of panic attacks or high blood pressure and like a heart attack risk and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Which just, that doesn't even feel like fringe to say. It's like, yeah, I would imagine if you develop a routine of relaxing twice a day, your blood pressure would probably go down.
Yeah, yeah.
And TM is cool because it's one of the most medically studied forms of meditation, which helped me kind of get into it as sort of a practical guy. I was able to kind of be like,
scholarly.
Yeah, scholarly dude. I was like, okay, there's a web of like hard science facts about this, which gets back to what we were talking about, like the mysteries of science, of like, you know, they don't totally understand why all these things work the way they do, but
they do. Well, and that's where, like, and talking again about the mysteries of science, like, and something, you know, I listened to Sam Harris's podcast a decent amount, and he's, you know, he's an unashamed atheist, but I think he's good at not being a militant atheist, even though he clearly, maybe some people might disagree with that, but like, you know, because he strongly articulates why he's an atheist sometimes, but like, he also, I mean, I read one of his books called Waking Up, which is talking about like how we know all the individual pieces of what makes up consciousness, but we still can't really explain why, like, what consciousness fully is. Science can't really explain why consciousness it's a phenomenon versus like, you know, we have all these like things that take in, you have your eyes that take in, you know, visual stimuli, blah, blah, blah. But like, the tying it all together part is still a mystery.
There's all kinds of really interesting kind of fringy new agey science about, the nature of consciousness in that way. My girlfriend really liked and had me read, and I didn't totally connect with it, but parts of it I really dug. This idea of like biocentrism, which is this guy Richard Lanza wrote about it, which is essentially getting to the ideas of everything kind of being united by consciousness and everything in the universe kind of be participating in a consciousness, and the science and physics that supports those ideas. You know, that I didn't totally click into that because it's one of those books that to me looked like borderline self-published. You know what I mean? And the writing is like just indecipherable enough to me that I'm kind of like, you arrived at a conclusion that you want me to agree with, but I don't totally know how we got there.
Right. It's his anti-Puerto Rican manifesto.
That's right. But it is a very interesting book. But yeah, it's funny. I think there's a lot of like, I think I've enjoyed becoming a little more putting aside some of my more like practical atheistic ideas and opening my mind a little more to ideas about the field of consciousness and the collective unconscious.
Yeah.
Kind of just because almost in like a comic booky, like sci-fi geek way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where I'm like, this is a cool idea that we would be connected like this. And actually, one of my favorite fringe theories about it, I read this whole book by this guy, Colonel Brian Reese, who was like a military doctor. And he has become a speaker at a lot of David Lynch Foundation events. you know, which is tied to TM. And he specifically is a big part of using transcendental meditation as a means to treat post-traumatic stress disorder for soldiers, for veterans, which is an amazing program. And he, but he also has these really, then he, I read his book and it's full of all this like weird fringe stuff that is kind of like borderline, but I'm like, I hope this is real, which is this idea of, it's called the universal defense strategy.
Okay.
And it's this concept where if you deploy a certain number of people who practice a specific type of advanced transcendental meditation, and they make up a specific ratio of the population in a geographic area,
okay,
you deploy them to a hotspot, a place with a lot of like violence.
Okay.
If they...
Like the Comedy Store.
Where people are killing every night. Where the roast battles rage.
Watch out, you get caught up in the crossfire.
No civilians here. Yeah, like a hotspot like the above the Comedy Store. Yeah. God, there should be some meditators there. To, yeah. But the idea is you have those people, you have a, it's like they have it down to like, they have to be a specific ratio of the population in that area. I forget what the fucking math of it is, but they, that then if they do that over a long period of time, violence will decrease in that area.
Wow.
And it's one of those that I'm like, that's sounds insane.
Right.
Right. Of like, you know, and this guy's advocating it as like a military tactic, but he cites two times they tried it.
Mm-hmm.
And one specifically was in like Washington, D.C. in the 90s, like in kind of the inner city of Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Yeah.
They only had funding to do it for like 6 months or something, but they claim that violent crime statistics were reduced in that time.
Well, dude, I do wonder, and I feel like I saw a study on this recently, but like how, why are we not teaching meditation, like totally secular meditation of any kind to kids like in school?
Yeah.
Because I wonder about that all the time. Like,
I'm
how much
big
more
on
peaceful,
that. There's, you know? There are a few programs like that, like the, my instructor for TM grew up in one of those communities. There's a community in Iowa that like the whole town does like TM and like, wow, they do it in school and stuff. I forget the name of the town.
Pleasantville.
Pleasantville. Yeah, it's Pleasantville. Yeah. It's out there all black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, especially, and TM is really big about saying this is not a religion. And as an organization, I've found they've been really hands off. Once you do the introductory class, you have access to like TM events for free, but they really don't like bombard you too hard with like trying to get you to go or anything, and they're very explicitly like, this is not a religion. So I've been pleasantly surprised of like, there's no culty trappings to this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there can be if you want to like buy into it to that degree, but it's very individualized, which I respond to. And in that sense, because it's secular, because it's individualized, yeah, why can't we be giving these tools to children, either mindfulness or TM? You know, it's just calming down and like focusing and relaxing. And I think why I end up believing what I ended up convincing myself of this universal defense strategy theory, because it doesn't seem insane to me that, okay, so like an area like inner city Washington, D.C., and you, now we're 500 people are moving in who do this type of meditation. Those 500 people are going about their day in that area. They're going to the grocery store and they're exchanging a kind word with the grocery store clerk or whatever. They are calm and thoughtful in a way that, even if it's not like as overt as telling the grocery store clerk, hey, a nice haircut or whatever, yeah, even if it's just a, yeah, normal transaction, but they're doing it from that place, it's not insane to me that would have an effect. Like I feel significantly calm. I have a better day when a random stranger is very nice to me.
Yeah.
And like if you happen to ride an elevator with a friendly person,
yeah,
it's a treat.
And then when somebody makes a joke that actually is like a funny,
yes,
joke, like, wow.
Yeah. That's such a gift.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of, in my mind, that's the logic I applied to that.
That's awesome, man. What, man, yeah, dude, I could talk so much more bad about being respectful
gone
of your time.
Oh, good.
Because I think we're
well, sure,
over it a little bit.
I mean, well, that's fine. I'm
didn't even talk about like ayahuasca or anything. I could talk
which I haven't done.
That.
I haven't done any of that. Have you done any of that?
Yeah, man.
You did ayahuasca?
I've been getting definitely more and more into it.
Give me, like, I got a little time. Give me the cliff notes of your ayahuasca.
Right. Let me give you the cliff notes of talking to fucking God, man. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm kind of not kidding. But,
No, totally. I have a couple buddies who have done it, and yeah.
Nah, dude. So, like, okay. So I started going in November, and I can't say where I've been going, but I've been going... I ended up thinking I was just going to go for one night, and because you can go for one or two nights. Ended up staying for two nights because the first night, you know, I've been connecting to what we were talking about is just like, it is totally, it's supercharged my pantheism type tendencies.
Yeah, cool.
And like, I definitely feel a deeper connection to mystery and to something divine outside of me. Or maybe not even outside is not the right word, but sense of connection to a greater part of me. Like, it's something that, whether it's a connection to, like, I feel, because it's okay. So, like, in the process of ceremony, and it's something else you reminded me of when you're talking about TM, it's like, it's all individual work that we're doing at the place I go. And it's, I think, any place you go, you're doing individual work. You're supposed to mostly be quiet to yourself, and you know, you'll be you'll purge and stuff just through vomiting or crying, or
that stuff is hardcore,
you know, whatever,
man.
It is, but you know, a lot of it, you know, the place I go, it's a wordless ceremony, so you're not allowed to speak English, you're not allowed to like talk to people, you're not supposed to direct energy towards anybody, you're like, they can't like stare at somebody, like wave,
and you're in a group,
you're in a group, and there's people playing, like the leaders are playing music and singing chants, and you can sing along with them if you want to, and playing like sound healing, like drums and like crazy instruments, like, you know, like wind chimes and other a bunch of stuff I've never heard
of.
And it's something that, I mean, it feels like it's been so therapeutic for me. It's been something where you know, you go there to do internal work, to work on healing a lot of trauma. A lot of people do it for childhood trauma, which I've worked with, or like current, maybe you're looking for guidance on current situations that I've gone there for, and I feel like I've gotten clarity.
Cool. That's amazing.
You know, situations that have felt like coin flips, where I've been like, you know, and where maybe I could have saved myself a lot of time and energy by just doing the thing where you do the coin flip and you're like, oh, you, whichever way you want it to land is the way you should go,
right,
type thing. But like, you know, I got a little more.
But it's cooler to get it after vomiting.
Right. Right. But no, man. And what's crazy, the craziest part of it all, I mean, it's something that has totally reinforced my belief for how much we need community, and how much we need like a community of people where we all have each other's back, like an altruistic, not even just towards the outside world, but for each other. And you know, because a lot of what people talk about is like integration work. So like 10%, a lot of people say like 10% of what you get out of an ayahuasca ceremony, only 10% of it is during the actual ceremony. 9% is like how you take these lessons back into your life. How do you apply them? Like, how do you change your life? How do you like change your habits? Or how do you like, what steps do you take based on the information downloads you just got, which you get a lot downloaded.
Yeah, I bet.
At a time. Something I've heard somebody, mentioned was how we wouldn't even need integration if we all had community. Like if we could just consistently have the community. And and meaning that like, when I felt this at these at the groups I've gone with, where I felt so much unconditional love, and I felt so much like everybody was there, at least even if they weren't so super hardcore, super quote unquote believers in it, like we were all like humans really trying to work on ourselves, really there for good purposes. It wasn't like, you know, and it is a context of a religious ceremony. It's not just for like, let's go do, you know, drugs out in the fucking Amazon or whatever.
It's
it
different.
Is. Yeah. And what's crazy, man, is that like I've started playing music and a lot, like, and I've started like finding my musical voice. I had learned guitar like 7 years ago, but I barely play. I played like maybe once a year. And the idea of me playing in public was always terrifying. Like I was like, there's no way in hell I will ever play any, like sing in public. That was always more terrifying to me doing any open mic.
Yeah. No kidding, man. I mean, it's so much more vulnerable.
Right. Soul bearing.
Yeah.
And yet here I found myself a couple of times now where I'm like leading some songs and like find myself, and I
that's
just
great.
It's wild. And what's been really cool for me, and like it took my it took some of my alchemy of like Christian baggage to a next level in terms of like I was already mostly okay with it, but like I've started bringing some Christian song, like some old like church songs, like you know, Kumbaya, or like This Little Light of Mine.
Sure,
like
some
that like sometimes like makes you laugh at how cheesy it can kind of sound.
Sure.
But then like in the context of offering it as a prayer, it actually, I don't know, it's been powerful for me, and I feel like some other people have
that's cool.
Been momentous for them too. And
I think that
ways.
I think that shows you how universal some of those songs and ideas of Christianity are.
Exactly.
That is, it is just as, that's like one of the most, this little light on mine, I'm going to make it shine.
Yeah.
That's pure new age, dude.
Yeah, dude. It really is.
Yeah, it really is. And it, you know, it's just, and that's what, again, that's what gets to that understanding Christianity. And I've had like tastes of what you're describing in, cause I've done mushrooms and LSD, and I've had tastes of that on mushrooms handful of times that I've done it. It does kind of quickly get you to, you look over at your friend and you're just like, we're all doing our best. You know,
yeah,
it's got that
man.
Kind of vibe to it. But I will, part of what has kept me from maybe trying ayahuasca, even though I've been curious about it and I've had some friends who've done it, is part of what keeps me from doing mushrooms more often as well, which is I have a hard time, with how intense those drug experiences can be. I have you know, I take a very small, I always take kind of the smallest dose I can. I don't like to go out far. I really don't like to give up control in that degree. I don't like the feeling of kind of getting lost in the sauce and am I ever going to come back? That's a really hard zone for me to be in.
Yeah.
And I think I'm too nervous for it. I think it freaks me out.
Well, you're not alone in that by far.
Not at all. But so that's what keeps me from, I'm like, I have just a tough enough of a time with mushrooms on that I'm like, I don't know if I could hang with it. I don't know if I could handle that. What would you say to someone like me who's on this side of the fence about like, I don't know if I could take that plunge.
It's
more than that. I don't know if it would be right for me to.
Okay.
I don't know if I am the right personality to engage with that in a fully positive way.
Okay. What I would say is, first of all, not, you know, psychedelics aren't for everybody. And
I mean,
I can't
be said enough.
I can't say that if you strongly feel inclined to not take it, that you should, because that would be, that just sets you up for a bad trip.
I
honestly
always think about that with like weed. Like, just look at how tough a time so many people have on weed.
Yeah.
You know,
man.
So like, why, how could mushrooms and ayahuasca be for everybody?
Right. Well, that's funny is like, ayahuasca is actually, it made me quit smoking weed and drink. I haven't drank or smoked weed since
that happened to my friend.
Yeah.
My buddy, did ayahuasca. He was in Thailand and he like got back and he's like, I did ayahuasca for like 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
He was like at a retreat and he's like, and now I'm sober.
Yeah. That's me, man. I don't like, except for psychedelics, but like, I don't, you know, and, but, what I would say is like, if you are feeling that it's, if you don't feel like it's right for you, then just don't do it. So let me just preface everything
right
by that.
Yeah, absolutely.
B, something that I think, cause I think the most common thing I've heard with every person who's hesitant to take any psychedelics is that like, I don't want to give up control. That's a common thing I hear.
Yeah.
Most of my friends who have said that. What I would say is, I would sometimes I've wanted to say this is like, well, maybe sometimes giving up a little bit of control is not a totally bad thing in the sense of
completely.
We're how much in control are we truly anyway?
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
You know, and that's like a common desire of the ego is to try to grasp and try to control as much of things as possible and try to overextend itself and try to maintain as much order as possible. So I think now that doesn't mean you have to go all in on a psychedelic trip, but you know, maybe finding ways to lose control in other ways. And you know, and it is important to make sure you have a good group you go with. If you do, especially like any psychedelic setting is so huge. Like,
yeah.
Who you take it with.
Incredibly important.
And so like, and there's a lot of, you know, false shamans out there. A lot of like, you know, people who are not administering sacrament, correctly.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's very, but like in the settings I've done it, you know, there's a lot of talk beforehand. Like they explain kind of the whole process of like, and you feel very much I was never concerned about my physical safety.
Yeah, see, that's what I need. Because the first time I heard about it, my buddy did it like in the Amazon, and it ended up being this kind of setup where like the guy kind of gave him the dose in this like little solo cabin that my buddy was in.
Oh, wow.
And he kind of gave him the dose and did a little bit of a like ceremony, just a small one, and then was kind of like, all right, see ya, and left.
Yikes.
And then my buddy was alone in a cabin for like 9 hours.
Oh my
just
God.
Like vomiting and shitting his brains.
Yeah, now that sounds like something, I mean,
yeah,
me personally, maybe I'm kind of more could do that.
He
now,
still,
like,
I think overall was kind of like, yeah, it was a cool wild trip, but no, I would want to be taken care of in the way you're describing.
Yeah, and there's the places I've gone, there's guardians who were like, that's their whole job, is like they hear you vomiting, they'll give you a new bucket, or like you're having a really tough time, they'll like walk with you outside and like kind of like help.
Yeah,
facilitate whatever
that's nice.
They can do. Now that doesn't mean to say that there's still a lot of people that have difficult times, because there's a lot of, it can bring up a lot of, especially if you come in, you know, part of the process is like when you first decide to take ayahuasca, you are already setting an intention of some sort of like, what do I want to work on? What do
a
I
a big
wanna...
one?
And so a lot of stuff can come up, a lot of and things that you didn't necessarily expect to come up. And so I'm not going to say you can have always an easy time, but
no,
at the same time,
not.
I've had some difficult journeys, but by the end, and this is where some of the music helps a lot, because sometimes like you'll be having a difficult time, but then you'll hear this like, you know, these peaceful prayers, whether it's in Spanish or it's just an instrumental, and you feel you can like kind of get connected back, like they're like a tether back to reality a little bit. And so, yeah, I've had some difficult times, but then they've almost always ended up cathartic by the end, and like, oh wow, like I've now gotten this different insight on this, or like I would dive really deep into like feelings of loneliness I've had, or like, you know, one time I've dealt with like not being able to feel like I could be authentic as a kid, like I couldn't be my true self, and how the kind of having to pretend to be like a different person from who you are.
Something up with my mic?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm good. Okay.
So yeah, like what was the third thing you said? We had like, you said the control, and there was some other aspect I feel like you were asking me about, or,
within that control, I don't know, kind of in the way that we're talking about of people with mushrooms or weed or something. I don't know that I am necessarily like, I don't know, even like chemically
built the right
to handle it.
Right. That part, it's impossible for me to say. I do think like, as far as personality types, I think most people can get something out of an ayahuasca journey, just because I feel like it's...
Yeah, well, it's so overpowering. Like, how could you not?
Well, and it's so like, I think something I've heard, kind of the thing I was talking about, I've heard this guy, Dr. Gabor Mate, who works with addicts in Vancouver, and he also does ayahuasca trips and helps facilitate those and separately. But he talks about how almost all of us grow up with a sense of sort of some mild, anywhere from mild to severe trauma of like not being able to express who we are as children in order to receive some kind of parental love. And a lot of it's benevolent, like from like, okay, don't express. Like a kid will want to say like, oh, I want to touch the hot stove. That's my genuine expression.
Right,
and your mom's like, don't do that. And so like, but there's lots of little instances like that, or in some cases where you have to kind of pretend to be something you're not, like, cause your parents don't let you be gay or whatever it is. You get a lot of pain from, oh, I don't get, it's almost like this lesson gets baked into your bones of like, I don't get to be who I am and still receive the love I need.
Sure.
You know? And so working with that has been very, very powerful.
Yeah, that's so fundamental. And I think you're absolutely right that everyone has some version of that, some degree of that is like, because that's just being a person.
But it's definitely not something, you know, it's definitely not something to be taken lightly. I will say I think ayahuasca has been an overall gentler experience than some mushroom or LSD trips I've had.
Not hard for me to believe.
Yeah. I mean, I even recently had a bad mushroom trip where it was just me in my apartment, and I, for whatever reason, that I don't know what if I had a bad batch or if I think I probably just didn't give it, I wasn't like, is too spur of the moment. I didn't have enough preparation for it. Didn't have enough respect for it. It really, psychedelics have to be respected, or else they'll teach you why they should be respected.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you thought you could do this on your way to the airport?
Yeah, and you like, can't. And so it wasn't like, you know, life ruining or anything, but I was like laying right there on the floor for like a good hour, just being like, man, I can't. Like it was tough at times. But
yeah, that's how those go.
So it's definitely something, if you ever wanted to consider it, you should consider it. You should discern it. And,
all right. Well, let's go do it right now.
All right, man. Like, I don't know if you noticed that giant brew I had.
Oh, shit. Oh, is that ayahuasca on the stove?
Yeah, man. All that shit I was talking about, respect and ceremony.
Planning. Fuck that shit, dude.
Guardians. I'm good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done a few. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's awesome, man. I'm happy to hear that. That sounds like a cool experience for you.
It's powerful. Very nice. You fed, like... You said you have some good psychedelic experience.
Yeah, right? I think I've had a couple of those. I think it's impossible to have the basic mushroom experience of like watching the ground breathe and really getting it snaps you into that context. It lets you know you're small in the universe, but also amazing within it. You know, yes. I've had some of those, and I've had that experience of then having like a couple weeks after that where I am more actively, it's at the forefront of my mind and I'm bringing it into my regular sober life.
And to me, that feeling is indistinguishable from what those cathedrals are trying to get at. Which is that sense of God, which is I am small and yet I am great simultaneously.
Absolutely.
I am nothing and I'm everything.
Everything. What I would really love to do, and maybe it starts with trying ayahuasca and opening that door, but I think in a perfect world, I would be able to achieve something like that completely sober on my own through the power of my own mind.
Well, and that's what Ram Dass talked about, like why he stopped taking LSD. You
know, right.
The king of LSD.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he ended up going a spiritual path because he said, you know, no matter how much LSD I get, I couldn't stay quote unquote high. Like there'd always be a come down.
Yeah.
And so to him, a spiritual practice, and whether it's through intense, not just meditation, but just like through, you know, his practice of, I think it's bhakti yoga, which is, the yoga of devotion and love. I'm messing some part of that.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, that's essentially devoting your life over to love and through a meditation process and a bunch of other, maybe it's through volunteering intensely or through some other, there's lots of different potential paths to God. The feeling of God, meaning like, this feeling of oneness, not the feeling of, you know, an old man in the sky.
And just like, I wouldn't want to, I think you'd hit a point where you're like, it's weird that I have to keep taking this poison to feel a truth, you know?
Well, and that's what, you know, that's truly what a lot of people think with like alcohol too. And
of course.
A lot of people need that to feel normal or to feel better, which is I think anytime the appeal of like almost any drug.
Yeah.
Except I don't feel this about psychedelics. I have to distinguish this. I think the appeal of, I should say, alcohol and a lot of times weed is...
Yeah, kind of your more recreational Friday night drugs.
Right. It's, I think, why they're so insanely popular is because it's a really quick shortcut for your ego to get out of the way a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Or to be quieted or to like...
And then I think what you quickly discover is that it's a real false road.
Yeah.
Where it's actually... And especially if you make a habit of any of it, you end up right back where you started.
Right. Well, you know, that's what exactly. And I think one of the messages I got from my first ayahuasca trip, which is why I stopped drinking and smoking weed, is that they were, and the people at the place I go both drink and smoke weed. Like not everybody goes on these trips and ends up sober.
Yeah, but it's interesting that you're the second person I've heard talk about specifically getting sober.
And for me, it was something that was already percolating in the back of my mind that I needed to do. And so this was kind of the final kick of like this is not the path to your self-love, and you know this is not the way to love yourself because you've seen the dark roads both of these have taken
you down. Absolutely.
And my dark roads with both of those have been relatively scot-free.
Sure.
But
that's the thing, it doesn't even have to get that dark. any day you wake up and kind of regret and what happened the day before.
Yep.
Because you're like, God, Jesus.
Right. And lost opportunity. I mean, the biggest thing for me, I feel like, is like lost opportunities. Yeah. Just lost time. And like,
yes, that's the big one.
That's when I could feel like I'm staring into the gaping void.
If we start talking about the amount of time I've wasted high on the couch.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway.
Well, good.
All
right.
Yeah, man. We can talk more.
We'll do some ayahuasca.
Yeah, we'll do it, dude. Again, I guess that feels good.
Yeah,
right?
Let's wrap it up.
Yeah, man. I think that's pretty much it. We didn't even talk about. I partially didn't want to talk about this because I feel like people want to talk to you about, like, you did a fucking half hour.
I did. I did a Comedy Central half hour special.
It was amazing.
It was really amazing. Yeah, thanks.
It's not out yet, right?
It's not out yet.
I didn't totally miss it.
It hasn't come out yet.
Okay.
And I don't know when it will come out, but I'm hopeful it'll be, we're recording this in March of 2018. I'm hopeful that it'll be coming out sometime in like May.
That's awesome,
like sometime in early summer. It was really incredible. You know, I grew up watching those Comedy Central half hours. So yeah. It was some real like bucket list.
It's been so
life
surreal.
Accomplishment stuff.
A little bit.
Yeah, it was really surreal. I was definitely out of my body for the first couple minutes.
Wow, man.
It was weird.
Did it go well? Do you feel like
it did go well?
That's awesome.
I had a really nice time. I was very proud of what I did. The only slight thing, and this is so exactly how this would have happened for me, was my closer didn't totally play. My final joke didn't totally land the way it has before and I know it can. And so I walked off stage with this feeling of like, huh. You know, that was then overall completely supplanted by feelings of extreme joy and gratefulness and, you know, just incredible luck and appreciation for what I had done. But there was a big piece that was kind of like, damn this! Why didn't they follow me on that punchline?
Oh no!
But it was a really cool experience, and my family was there, and it just a really fun. It's one of those where like this is only my second time doing stand up on TV. I did Adam Devine's house party before, and both those things are like Adam Devine's house party, relatively small audience at the end of the day of who ends up seeing that. But so exciting for us as comedians to like get those shots because you always wanted those. But I had the same thought with both, which was very exciting and cool for me, which is like, you know, you never know how far you're going to get in this business or how far you even want to or will be able to or whatever. So it's just really cool to cross a milestone like that and be like, no matter what happens going forward, I will have always done this.
Yeah, man.
You know?
That's so cool and beautiful. And it's like so cool to like, just to remembering back to like, you know, just seeing you at mics. And
yeah,
just,
man.
And seeing, like the, I mean, really though. It's
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It's a cool and surreal thing for me to see like my friends and just people I came up with like getting awesome success like that.
I know.
Really
cool. I really appreciate you saying that. And it's the same for me when I see other people do it. And the batch of comics that I did this show with, like our friend Ryan O'Flanagan.
Oh yeah,
Did it the same night.
Yeah.
And yeah, he was one of the first friends I made in stand up in LA. So just to be backstage there with him was just like, yeah, it's crazy.
Well, if you're listening to this, definitely check that out.
Check it out. It's you know, they make it hard to find.
Yeah. and you're a good tweeter.
I'm a great tweeter. I'm solid. Yeah. I'm fine. You can find me. It's that Devin Field.
Right. Not this Devin Field.
No. It's that. Which is a terrible handle riff. I picked. It was so bad.
Well, you've committed to it.
It's too late.
Well, dude, thanks for coming over, man.
Thank you very much, man.
This is awesome.
All right.
That was great. And that's the show. Follow Devin Field on Twitter. Watch his half hour when it comes out. Keep up with this dude. And keep up with yourselves. Love yourself. Choose things that serve you. And keep those things that serve you in your life. And serve yourself from time to time. I love you. Namaste.
Campfire.